first annual Golden State Comic Con for commercial artists and cartoon buffs gets underway this weekend at the U.S. Grant Hotel. Artist Shel Dorff says he hopes to make this event an annual thing.
And this is a chance for the amateur fan and the amateur writer to really meet with the professionals and find the magic secret of how it's done.
How long have you been interested in the cartoonist set? When did you first start getting them together, and when did you start collecting?
You really want to know.
Comics for me was like what people describe a religious experience.
Art has always informed who we are as a society.
The first time I ever went to Comic-Con, I think it was completely overwhelming, but at the same time, it's also like nirvana.
I grew up in the 50s when everybody read comics.
It really is the cast-offs of society that have found each other.
Walking into Comic-Con the first time was almost like walking into the internet years later.
I knew I wanted to make comics, but I didn't know anything about how to make them.
My first San Diego was an overwhelming experience.
Scary big. It could be as many as a million people making Comic-Con stuff happen.
It is the inflection point where geek culture met pop culture and overtook it.
The power of Comic-Con came into focus simply the first time I attended. It was shocking.
Everyone who is here tonight, the reason why they're in the field they're in, they went into it for romantic reasons. They went into it to help themselves to grow and become certain things. And because of their influence, they romanced us into wanting to live. That's what it's all about. Your love of comic strips and the kind of art that we're all fascinated with is the love of high romance, the love of life itself. The ability for each of us who works in the field, one way or the other, to say to you, yes, there's much negativity. Yes, there's much to criticize in the world. But there's much excitement and much beauty. And people like the cartoonists, the illustrators I'm sharing this evening here with, do that sort of thing for us. They make us want to go on living. It's a very important thing.
Greetings, fangirls, fanboys, and mundanes alike. Brink Stevens here. Cosplay pioneer, the original Scream Queen, marine biologist, comic book creator, author, and filmmaker. I also happen to be the widow of late comics legend Dave Stevens, who put me in the pages of the award-winning classic, The Rocketeer. But that's not all. I'm also one of the foundational members of what would eventually become known as the San Diego Comic-Con. After 5 decades, and counting, Comic-Con has exponentially grown into the largest pop culture event worldwide. Just ask our pals over at the Guinness Book of World Records. My longtime colleagues from the con invite you now to join us for a rather novel experience in storytelling, stringing together the intimately personal anecdotes and unfiltered reflections that may occasionally contradict one another, but together tell the entire story, not only of Comic-Con, but the evolution of modern fandom. So hold on tight, because this story is rare and in near mint condition. Grab your bag and board, and let's travel back in time. In the years leading up to the first Comic-Con, fans of comic books, sci-fi, and fantasy were outcast from the mainstream. And just as any outcasted group of people would do, they started to find each other. They were the aspiring cartoonists, comic book collectors, and underground zine writers of the time, the first geeks, and they wanted to connect. Here's one of Comic-Con's founding members, Dave Clark.
San Diego Comic Convention started really with two groups of people. And one of those groups went to the high school that I went to, Crawford High School, here in San Diego. Greg Bear, Scott Shaw, John Pound, Roger Friedman, and myself. Crawford High School had 3,700 students the year I was a senior, my graduate. One of the largest high schools in the world. You know, science fiction fans, comic fans were at the time, little tiny niche subculture. And that was something we talked about every day. Crawford High School encouraged students to organize clubs for their special interests. There's probably a chess club and a Latin club. Well, there was an underground film club. We didn't really know what underground movies were, really. You know, this is the late 60s. Underground sounded cool. And we found a willing teacher to be the teacher sponsor for it. And it brought together the science fiction, fantasy, comic, and film fans at Crawford High School and put us all in one room. We were all talking to each other at lunch and anyway, but that kind of formalized it. Pre-internet, it's hard to connect with other people that liked the stuff you did. I was lucky that I went to a school with so many fans.
The film club was pretty neat because all of a sudden I met this group of kids at the high school that were all into films and science fiction and comics. And it was like a mini convention in a sort, or a precursor, I should say.
In those days, it was too geeky to even let your fellow students know that you liked comic books, let alone have a place to go talk about them.
Crawford High Underground Film Society met in a bungalow on the campus. I think we met once a week, and it was really mostly kind of a show and tell and discuss because we were all buying the latest Ace double paperback science fiction books and the latest Marvel and DC comics.
Our social group spanned all the classes. There was no division between seniors, juniors, freshmen. And some of the guys graduated in 68. Greg Bear, Scott Shaw graduated. They were all going off to, you know, their higher education, but they stayed very connected to this group. In fact, they would still show up on campus. And I did the same thing when I graduated in 1969. The following year, I was writing the comic strips with John Pound for the school paper. So I was actually on campus often.
Our real motive, I think, was just to kind of enjoy what we liked with each other. We'd talk about what movies we last saw. We'd make plans on which movies and things, events we wanted to see.
Actually, our first enterprise was a tremendously ambitious one. We actually formed a film club. And so we set out to make a version on film of Ray Bradbury's short story, A Sound of Thunder. And it was interesting how we pulled resources from various things that are available to us. Probably first and most important resources, we had parents who were willing to drive us to these places because none of us had driver's licenses yet. So, for instance, John Pound, his mother ran a Montessori school, and so we were able to use that for doing office-type scenes. Scott Shaw, his father, was in the security force at the San Diego Zoo as a recent Navy retiree. He was able to get us onto the grounds and kind of behind the scenes at the San Diego Zoo for shooting jungle-type scenes and so on. And also a number of people, like Dave Clark in particular, was getting pretty talented with doing stop-motion animation, and so the plans were to do that for the dinosaur scenes and so on.
It wasn't that we were watching Kenneth Anger. I didn't know who Kenneth Anger was at the time. But we liked strange and interesting films, and our idea was to make. We thought of them as underground films because they were amateur films.
My dad got us into the zoo and got us into, since he was a security guy, we got to go like on the service roads and stuff. And
the film was never finished. It was far too ambitious for our abilities at the time. But it was a great focus for our energies.
I didn't realize that there was another group of fans in San Diego.
So the Patrick Henry people actually came later. Wendy, you've interviewed her. She was from there. Barry, I think, went to Mission, but he was in junior high. He was 12 when we started, actually. He was our youngest. So there was the Crawford guys, Scott Shaw, Greg Bear, those guys. But we, the founding group of Comic-Con, out of the six of us, three of us went to Kearney High School, and we were all from the same basic neighborhood in San Diego. We were all young comic dealers, so we had that in common, and that's how we met.
I really never knew anybody at Crawford, really. The way things were in San Diego, the junior highs fed to their high schools, pretty much.
So, yeah, we had no contact with the guys at Crawford High, and we didn't know they existed. They didn't know we existed.
David Clark, Scott Shaw, John Pound, Greg Bear, all these people who happened to be at the same high school, and this remarkable sort of concentration of talent and interest in science fiction, comic books, and that whole series of interconnected genres all happened to be at the same place, and happily, we all found each other.
Not only did they find each other, they also found their talent. Here's cartoonist and Comic-Con's first publicist, Scott Shaw.
I've always wanted to be a cartoonist since the time I was about, I don't know, three. Reading a lot of comic books and funnies in the newspaper, you know, I taught myself how to read with looking at comics because the words supported the pictures and vice versa.
In the year before I went to Crawford High School, I was walking home from junior high and I saw this newspaper in the gutter that had like a little comic strip, and it was done by a fellow named Scott Shaw. that's cool cartooning, and that looks like fun, and I'd like to do that too. So the next year I signed up for journalism when I went to Crawford, and Scott was the resident cartoonist.
Scott's actually one of my best and longest term friends. I've known each other since high school. The first person I know that actually created comic books, first in undergrounds and later on in through mainstream comics as well.
Yeah, Scott and I hit it off from the very beginning, and I appreciated the kind of art that he did, even though it certainly wasn't what I was pursuing at the time. But it was more of his volubility and his articulateness and his sense of humor that attracted me, and we've been great friends all these years.
I do know that in a related incident that Scott tried to give Jack Kirby a dirty poster.
I had met Jack a couple of times, and one of the times he told me, well, he asked me what I was working on, how I was trying to become a professional. And I said, well, I'm doing underground comics now. And his answer was, oh, I like underground comics. Well, you know, when you're young and foolish, you're thinking, and you don't know many professional cartoonists, and Jack was so open to everybody, I'm thinking, well, I guess he likes to read Zap Comics and the Freak Brothers and all that stuff. What I didn't realize was Jack was referring only to the fact underground cartoonists owned their own work, underground cartoonists drew in their own style, underground cartoonists for not being a major comic company, got a decent pay. $50 a page for each printing wasn't that bad in the 1970, 1971. So I thought, boy, Jack really likes underground comics. I'm going to do this poster in honor of him. And I found an old issue of Strange Tales that he'd done the cover for that had this kind of biped bulldog-looking alien standing in the middle of an arena. So I thought, well, let's make this into an underground version of Jack Kirby. So I added a big schlong that I had more or less learned how to draw from looking at S. Clay Wilson's underground comics. And now it's Deranged Tales, and he's saying, no human can beat me off. And at the bottom is signed by Scott Shaw in honor of Jack Kirby or something like that. I mean, I actually put Jack's name on it because I wanted people to know it was a swipe. Mike Towery was so impressed by it. Now, he won't like me saying him, but I can't help it. He printed up about 1,000 copies of it as a poster. I mean, looking back, Jack is looking at it, not only horrified that I signed his name to a piece of essentially pornography, but also that this is one of multiple copies of this poster. And he said, but I've got a family. And I still wasn't getting it. And I said, Jack, maybe you could just put this up in your closet, in one of the closets. And he's like looking at me like I've lost my mind, but not in an angry way. I think he was just trying to figure out what my intention was.
So I started hanging out with these people, and maybe like I'd go over to like Scott Shaw's house or Dave Clark's house and talk about books and science fiction, and they'd show me the things that they collected, and I just felt like I learned a lot from them because they were just these bright minds. They both had a great sense of humor.
John Pound was very good friends with Scott Shaw and Roger Friedman. John Pound was and is a very talented artist in a more sort of, you know, serious, realistic comic book way than, say, Scott Shaw was, who was more of a funny animal sort of comedic artist.
But John has done underground comics and overground comics. Probably his biggest claim to fame is he painted a lot of the Garbage Pail Kids cards back in the 80s, and even now I think he still works on that stuff.
Certainly one of the folks who was really involved very early on this, another San Diegan, was Greg Bear. It was interesting. Greg was always interested in science fiction, started off at San Diego State as an astronomy major and decided that, yeah, this is a little too mathematical for me, and I'm really more interested in the science fiction aspects of it, and so changed over to become a English and writing major. So I think Greg was a good example of both the people who were involved with getting Comic-Con started and also with people who were influenced by and motivated by Comic-Con to go forth and be fruitful and to produce the sorts of things that we would frankly like to read, and has been extraordinarily successful in that.
Greg was the first guy who ever
sold anything. And it was this little digest science fiction magazine that looked almost like a fanzine. I mean, it wasn't even as fancy as the other little digest magazines that were coming out at the time, but it was professional. But anyway, he was the first. Then John Pound and I were the first with Gory Stories Quarterly in 72. So we all had potential.
We used to make our own comic books. At first, it was literally making a comic book. It would be on 8.5 by 11-inch paper, stapled together, lettered, inked, everything, and bound together to make an actual comic book. And then later we found out about fanzines. This is back in the, late 60s, early 70s. And fanzines were kind of like what underground comics, or more like what independent comics are now. These are basically people who love comics would make their own comics, and they'd publish it. Some were as cheaply made as mimeograph. Others were full color. So it had the whole spectrum.
When I got into high school, I started writing letters to a friend of mine, Bill Richardson, who lived on the East Coast. And the letters evolved like over the course of a couple years from just letters and, you know, hey, I saw this movie and I bought this book and watched this TV show or heard about it. They evolved into single copy fanzines. And I would paint like a handmade cover on some of them with felt pens or acrylics.
These fanzines would tell you who did those comics. And then you'd start to look at them and say, oh, yeah, I can tell the same artist did this comic as did that comic. Even though it's not signed, I can tell it's that same style. And so you'd start looking for them. The fan aspect of it was becoming involved in the fanzine community in that I would occasionally write letters to the fanzines and subscribe to all of them.
Well, there were comic book stores in a few places. They hadn't very much reached Akron, Ohio. And for us, the only way that you could find out about comics and what was going on were through letters to the editor and fanzines. Through the fan letters, and I actually wrote a couple myself, we understood that there was more.
Letter columns in magazines were, and the fanzines and professional magazines were one of the key ways to find out what was going on. And way back in the day, Weird Tales, they would publish your address. This is before concerns about identity theft and privacy. They put your address in there. So you live in the middle, in the Midwest someplace, and you write a letter about how much you liked something, and you start getting mail from people who shared your interest.
Science fiction writer, author of Psycho, Mr. Robert Bloch, gave a talk on Lovecraft.
My own relationship with Lovecraft goes way, way back. I was 15 years old, living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when I read Lovecraft stories and Weird Tales and read in the letter column about other stories that had been published previously. Nowhere to get them. There were no paperbacks, no reprints. Wrote to the magazine, they didn't have any copies. So I decided to write my first fan letter to Lovecraft, and I did. I got an answer.
H.P. Lovecraft himself, the great H.P. Lovecraft, was in amateur journalism, and he edited and wrote for these publications that fostered his career and his writing abilities. That's very much like chat rooms that we have today.
Even as comic book clubs were popping up and zines were connecting fans around the country, back in San Diego, the first geeks were catching the attention of a couple of key players in Comic-Con's origin story.
But I wound up going to college. I got a scholarship because I needed a cartoonist, believe it or not. And I went to this party school out on Point Loma, which was near Ocean Beach, which was even then becoming the hippie center of San Diego.
Ocean Beach was the Haight-Ashbury of San Diego County.
Social misfits, outsiders, people on the fringes of mainstream, what was mainstream acceptable. There was obviously a lot of convergence with, you know, what was going on with the kind of hippie-yippie counterculture. There was a lot of convergence there. It was the fringes of what was mainstream acceptability.
In the 60s, there were head shops and record stores. There was a co-op market. This was definitely the hip part of town.
And on the main drag there was a science fiction bookstore, which I just couldn't believe.
Ken Kruger, he ran several bookstores, and he was an old-time science fiction fan. When I say old-time, meaning he was about my mom's age, and I bought some early science fiction comics from him.
Ken Kruger was a very hip guy. He was one of the attendees of the first science fiction con in New York in 1939. He'd been a book dealer, a publisher.
Ken's store was an eclectic grab bag.
I never was aware of this, but somebody once asked me, they said, did you ever notice there might have been a beaded curtain in front of one of those doors? Yeah, I never thought of going in there. Well, that's where the dirty books were.
In the front of the store there in Ocean Beach, it was, you know, comics, science fiction, paperbacks, that kind of stuff, like a regular bookstore. In the back was the inventory that actually made the money, which was porn.
It was California, you know, it was San Diego, California, and people were just tolerant. And the adults did not feel threatened that their children were going to the back of a dirty bookstore where there were marital aids and pornography or adult literature on sale, as well as science fiction books and pulps and things. And Ken never abused that. Ken never thrust that upon us. It was there, and he could joke about it. So we could place these things in their proper perspective, and the adults that were present, the older people, did as well.
The cluttered windows, they were dingy. They were fly-specked. You know, like dead flies in the window. There were curious displays of really nice books and then strange, you know, film magazines and stuff. You couldn't see in the shop all that well because of stuff in the front.
Ken wasn't a creepy guy in the slightest, though. He was like everybody's father.
His store was great. I mean, it was like Ken. It was a disheveled mess with lots of fun stuff all over the place. Sometimes he would dig through piles of stuff, you know, and he'd find something that he had no idea he had.
I have a Virgil Finlay portfolio, the published small press thing published in the early 1950s that I literally sat down and picked up a little stack of things and, you know, was the second item down in this stack. It's a treasure in my collection to this day. In there, there's a transmission from the Buddha to his follower, to the next one, and an unbroken chain to the present day. Well, this is the Dharma transmission of all of this culture, of fan culture. And Ken Kruger was a member of First Fandom. And so he was the guy.
Ken Kruger was an eccentric guy who had a very big heart and never looked for an iota of credit for anything. He was the opposite of Shell.
After moving to the area from Detroit, a more polarizing figure started attending the first Geeks Club meetings at Ken Kruger's bookstore. While his credits are often disputed, there's no doubt that he invigorated the burgeoning San Diego fan community in his way.
Another person who came into the orbit of this was then Shell Dorf, who had recently arrived from Detroit and become a San Diego native.
The meeting is actually held upstairs, which was where Shell Dorf was living at the time. So it was sort of a loft above the bookstore. You know, it was musty and, you know, it wasn't a place, you know, I would want to live.
You know, Shell seemed like an old guy to us. He was 36, you know, so that seemed pretty old to us. And that was the age of the generation gap, don't trust anyone over 30.
Shell was the main founder of the convention, recognized, you know, as the main founder of the convention, along with Ken Kruger and other guys in the group, Barry Alfonso and Mike Towery and Scott Shaw. But Shell kept it alive.
Those meetings at Ken's bookstores were really, that was the steering committee.
And at the end of every meeting, Shell Dorf would address like a state of the con. And he would get everybody quiet down, and he would give this stirring, mood-elevating cheerlead to all of us and talk about his youth, you know, with comics and newspaper strips and how important all this was and the creativity involved to her and, you know, learning to express ourselves and all that. And Barry and I used to sit in the back and just giggle at this because we thought this old fart, you know, what does he, you know, what does this guy know? What was interesting in hindsight was, of course, that here was, you know, Shell Dorf and Ken Kruger and these, you know, these hippies, you know, people like Dave Clark, you know, long-haired freaks who were a good generation older than us kids. And we were having these meetings in effectively what was a porn bookshop in Ocean Beach. I mean, looking back on it, you could, you know, if you took a bird's eye view of it, you could say, well, there's something really dodgy about this.
Dodgy? Maybe. But Shell and the first geeks were determined. And it all came from one simple inspiration, collection, and wheeling and dealing in rare and sought-after comic books.
In Detroit, Shell Dorf helped put together a convention that was focused on science fiction movies and comics for fans thereof. One of the things that happened at that convention that I remember was researcher and fanzine producer Jerry Bales going through dealers' bins to try to find all the issues of comics that had been published and what were the dealers charging for them, because they had to put together some sort of informational basis. So he's creating, in effect, Jerry Bales was creating Excel files from nothing. That was the sort of event which Shell Dorf helped put together that made it possible for information and collections and brainstorming to happen.
The Detroit Triple Fan Fair was really the model for Comic-Con, and it's what we understand today as a Comic-Con. One day, Shell's dad was looking at this thing called, I think it was the Pennywise Press, and his dad was like, hey, Shell, I'm looking in this Pennywise Press here, and there is somebody in here advertising that they want to buy comics, and I know you need money. Why don't you call this kid up and see if you can sell him some stuff and make some money? So Shell goes, oh, okay, I'll do that. So he called up his Barry Alfonso.
I had this idea of trying to get old back issues of comics. I actually had the idea of even going door to door, like it is 11-year-old looking for them. But it seemed more sensible to put an ad in a free weekly newspaper, Penny Saver, saying wanted old comics. And I gave my phone number.
So Barry's mom brought him over, and Barry's like looking at all the comics Shell has to sell, and he's going, yeah, you know, Shell, I'm just a kid. I'm just 12 years old. I just don't have the money. I can't buy all these comics. But, you know, there's this person here in San Diego, Richard Alf, who's just started advertising in Marvel Comics. You know, I bet if you got a hold of him, he could buy everything you've got.
He was one of the few people at the beginning who was actually collecting comic books and then realized, oh, other people want these things. So he's selling them and making a profit and was actually making pretty good money.
When John and I left Akron in 1975, we had both accumulated what today would be pretty impressive collections of comics. We had all the early Marvels and a lot of the Silver Age DCs, and there was literally no place or means to sell them. We wound up selling all of our comics to a dealer at a flea market in Summit Mall in Akron, Ohio, for pittance, pennies. But we thought this would help finance our road trip to San Diego. When we arrived in San Diego, there were a few comic stores there. Richard Alf's Comic Kingdom, Pacific Comics, one or two others. We realized as soon as we saw Richard Alf's buying list, we could have made five times as much money selling our comic books to him if we'd have thrown them in the trunk of the car.
So Shell got a hold of Richard, and Richard went over to Shell's place and was looking at his comics. And while he's looking at the comics to buy, Shell's telling him about the Detroit Triple Fan Fair. So Shell says to Richard, you know, do you think any fans here in San Diego would like to get together to do something like that here? So Richard said, well, you know, I can ask. I know some people. I can ask and we'll see. Richard and I had actually earlier been talking about doing like a comic collector swap meet in my backyard, you know, which obviously would have been much different from Comic-Con, but it would have been the first comic event in San Diego if we had done it. But then Shell came and actually gave us something better to work on. And so anyway, Richard came and talked to me, and I got a hold of Bob Sork. We all lived in the same neighborhood. You know, we talked about it and decided, okay, we'll go and give him a listen.
And out of that came a meeting that Shell called in the bedroom that he had in his parents' apartment in Claremont.
I know in later years, Richard actually became a pot dealer. I've heard from other people that he decided that the way pot was sold kind of clandestinely by shaky characters meeting in alleys or whatever, he just thought that was wrong and that it should be done in a businesslike manner, and it shouldn't be dangerous, and you shouldn't have to deal with sketchy characters, and you should be able to keep hours and give people schedules when they could beat you and be reliable. And so he tried to set up his whole business in that way. He was very much into business processes.
So I went to this meeting, and it was Sheldorf and a bunch of people 20 years younger than him. And he was showing slides of old Golden Age comic book covers. And among the people in the crowd there were Richard Alf and Mike Towery.
But then I get this call from Scott Shaw, and he says, come check it out. This group of kids is interested in putting on some kind of comic and science fiction convention. So I already knew what a convention was, but the idea of putting on one in San Diego seemed like a big stretch. And then Sheldorf was involved there, and he knew a lot of cartoonists, like Milt Caniff and Jack Kirby and just hundreds of people. He was like a super fanboy.
Sheldorf came to this meeting. What he said then is, we're meeting in Claremont, and so all of us, the Crawford Circle, showed up a few days later in the evening, and we had a formal meeting, and Shell got up, and Ken was there, Shell was there, and Shell made a pitch, basically. And I was just reading in the 1974 program book a thing by Shell talking about making the comparison to Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney films, where Mickey says, hey, we could put on a show right here in the barn, and all you kids can play a part. And that is exactly how he pitched it to us. And that's how it seemed.
And the question was, do we want to do just a comic convention, or do we want to do like a multi-genre, multimedia thing like they did at Detroit Triple Fanfare and include these other things, science fiction and film?
And, you know, you hear fans now complain about Comic-Con. You know, there's too much about TV and movies. Well, that was built into we didn't know it was a mission statement, but we had some sort of thing about it. But it was true. It was like, but back then, having an event that honored movies meant that somebody might have a 16mm print of King Kong. And I remember we even showed our castle films at the thing, you know, the old ones you'd buy in the magic department, at a department store. So it was all from a fan point of view.
So in fact, if you look at our original logo for the convention, which Scott Shaw does lettering for, but Shell designed it, he did like an outline of the state of California, and he put these three circles in the state outline, one for comics, or comic art, one for science fiction and one for film. And that's a thing that you actually hear a complaint made, that people say, oh, Comic-Con's not just about comics anymore. And well, it was never just about comics from the very beginning.
The trifecta of Comic-Con, I think what made it as important as it was that when Sheldorf started it, he realized that it wasn't just science fiction, it wasn't just comic books, and it wasn't just classic films, that they all needed each other in support to be able to be what they were. So that little bit of alchemy is what I think, by bringing those together, is what not only brought me, but a lot of other people into it.
When we return, you'll hear what happens when the catalytic elements of science fiction, fantasy, and comics collide against the backdrop of the 1969 moon landing, propelled by a little fairy dust from our mentor and friend, Forrest J. Ackerman. Back to Comic-Con Begins. I'm Brink Stevens. Here now is early Comic-Con contributor and physics professor Roger Friedman to tell us why the con came together at just the right time in our nation's history.
The timing of the first Comic-Con is really rather interesting, because it coincides very closely with the first landing on the moon on July 20th, 1969.
That's one small step for man.
It's interesting to note that the first Comic-Con happened within a few months of that. So all that was happening at the same time. It was a very transformative time for the nation as a whole, for the world as a whole. And I think people were beginning to think about space travel in a fashion they had not before. Certainly the space race had been going on for over a decade at that point, but the fact that the entire world was paying attention to events in space, something that had seemed like a completely science fictional idea in the not very distant past, really, I think, made everyone more conscious of the contributions of science fiction and thinking of the comic book and science fiction world as having such a large overlap with the science fiction world. It kind of made everyone, I think, more attentive to that entire universe of creativity.
Man's dream and a nation's pledge have now been fulfilled. The lunar age has begun.
After the moon landing, a lot of commentators who didn't know anything said, well, you know, who in science fiction ever predicted that we'd watch the landing on television? Well, as it turned out, somebody looked it up and they found that there were more than half a dozen stories that had that in it. Some of them all the way back to the 1940s, shortly after the V2 rockets became known. Science fiction has benefited from the space program because anytime you open more doors, you've got more doors to walk through. And space, after all, is a truly infinite horizon.
Part of where we live now, as opposed to 30 years ago, 40 years ago, is that the distance between reality or what becomes real and what is speculated is a lot shorter. To kind of make any progress or any kind of improvement, you have to be willing to think outside of the parameters of conformity that you're in.
The whole approach that you saw with computer people, the early versions of computer people, very much crossed over to science fiction. We knew them from conventions, you know, and they would tell us what they were doing. And sometimes people like Jerry Pournelle would get involved in the journalism of new computers and all that sort of stuff. And then he'd become a kind of a big wheel in promoting these things.
I can sort of see an analog, certainly, between some of the Silicon Valley startups and all that. In fact, I had a little bit of involvement with Steve Wozniak later on. So just sort of the enthusiasm, a lot of the Silicon Valley upstart and that led to economy, the character of like Steve Wozniak, the enthusiasm for what they did it as a hobby just because it was cool stuff to do. That same enthusiasm, I think, really existed with the comic industry.
You look at the banking collapse, the global financial collapse, the kind of questions that really need to be asked are outside of the box, which is like, well, is this kind of global market system, banking system, the right model? You know, is this the only way to do it? And that kind of nonconformist thinking is what's necessary to solve problems. That's speculative thinking. Yeah, you have to speculate in order to look at progress. And science fiction writers just did it for, you know, they wrote down those speculations for a living. There's also forewarning. I mean, you know, Philip K. Dick, I mean, there's a lot of quantum possibilities. This is the way things could be if we continue down these lines, or this particular technology offers these particular solutions. This is where we might wind up.
Also, the gaming industry was getting started, and that was even more connected. So we would go to conventions that were doing Dungeons and Dragons and all that kind of stuff, and that was in the early stages. And these things came out of role-playing games, RPGs, which were very popular in the 60s.
As the moon landing caught the world's attention, all the first geeks couldn't help but look back at all the stories of space travel and far-off worlds that had existed well before.
Here now is the Jupiter 2, the culmination of nearly 40 years of intensive research and the most sophisticated piece of hardware yet devised by the mind of man.
These stories were the beginning of what came to be known as sci-fi. But how did it begin, and how did it converge with comic book culture? Here's Comic-Con science fiction coordinator, Greg Baer.
As I look back over the years, I realized the major differentiation between literature and science fiction was science. That goes back to World War I. Just after World War I, when suddenly the literary people in England, the Virginia Woolf crowd, realized that science had killed a lot of the upper-class youth of England. And that was a major shock, a realization that science and technology were not necessarily friendly.
Science fiction was the cultural expression of a scientific technical elite, which wasn't finding a voice anywhere else in literature. So they invented it themselves. And Hugo Gernsback got permission from the editors of a bunch of radio magazines. Radio was the big high-tech miracle thing of the 1920s. he said, why don't I just publish a magazine that's got stories about this, and then we can put ads for the other magazines in Amazing Stories and maybe generate more readership, which actually worked, which is why the magazine survived. And none of the other magazines from that old publishing group exist today. After all, comic books got started from a short story in a fanzine in the middle 1930s called V Superman.
Jerry Siegel in the 1930s had a science fiction fanzine, and he actually published an early story in it about Superman. Not the character that it became for the comics, but it was like an early version of it. And he was into science fiction, and he was corresponding with Forry Ackerman.
Forry Ackerman introduced the term sci-fi in the 1950s because it rhymed with hi-fi, which was a big hip thing.
And there was a magazine started in 1958 called Famous Monsters of Filmland. And its editor was a guy named Forrest J. Ackerman. He was one of the old science fiction guys. He also was at the 1939 World Science Fiction Convention in New York. He was the first fandom guy.
So Forry Ackerman knew Siegel and Mort Weisinger, who became the chief editor of comics for Sparrow Comics at DC. He was a big fanzine publisher himself, along with Julius Schwartz. Julius Schwartz was a fan who helped put on the first big science fiction con, the Worldcon, in 1939, and started a literary agency for science fiction writers. And he ended up also at DC. And he was the one that started reintroducing superheroes and started what's called the Silver Age of comics. In the 50s, he brought the Barry Allen Flash, the new Flash, back in a comic called Showcase. And he gave origin stories that were more, tended to be more science-based because he was out of science fiction. And that was more in keeping with, in a way, society was, because science was obviously becoming, we could all see the effects, the technology that was happening.
In the mid-60s, with the baby boomers growing into young teens and such, monster movies and science fiction movies that took on a new life on television. And for kids like myself, I just loved old science fiction and horror movies, monster movies. And Ackerman loved science fiction movies, and he collected vastly. And so he became editor of this magazine. John Cameron and Spielberg and Phil Tippett and all of these guys that went to be big in film, all were Forry Ackerman's kids. He was our Uncle Forry, and people called him Uncle Forry. He hosted people at an open house every Saturday in his house in LA in the Acker Mansion. But then he came to all of the comic conventions and encouraged people to follow their vision. And a lot of guys who went on to really do things were nurtured by Forrest Ackerman.
The connection has been made. Universal Pictures presents Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
I remember Shell was a little protective of Forry because Scott Shaw drew a cartoon for Mike Towery's fanzine, Train of Thought, that suggested that when Forry was too old to do conventions anymore, he ought to be stuffed and have a cassette player in his back so he can keep telling the same stories over and over again. And, you know, personally, I think Forry could take it, but Shell was very defensive and thought that was in bad taste, you know? But I never had the impression that Forry got his feelings hurt. Forry was part of this world. These were his people. This was his tribe, and I think he could take a little bit of joshing from the younger generation.
Forry Ackerman, one of his credits is he was an honorary lesbian. Forry was working, I think, at an office that had something to do with the film industry, and there was this is the story as I understand it, and they had there was a woman working in there who was lesbian, and she was involved in this organization called the Daughters of Biletus, which was a early clandestine group helping LA area or Southern California lesbians to meet each other and socialize and whatnot. And obviously it wasn't something that could be above ground in those days. This one wanted to publish a newsletter, and Forry, you know, with his extensive fanzine experience and publishing experience, helped her to get going to publish this newsletter for whatever it was for the Daughters of Biletus. And then he started, under a pseudonym,
started writing lesbian fiction. So it had a certain popularity among the, you know, the readership for that. And so one day, the Daughters of Miletus and the authors, actual lesbians, were writing lesbian fiction. They had a party, and Forey showed up at it, and they were like, you know, you're a man, you can't come in here. This is a lesbian event, or, you know, party. And he was like, you know, explained who he was and all that. And they were like, oh, gee, you know, it's like, we don't know what to do because we really like your books and we like you, but, you know, we don't know what to do. And so they decided the solution they came up with was they named him an honorary lesbian, and they let him into the party, and he hung out with them. So
sci-fi and comic culture were on a collision course, and some of the pillars of the comic book industry weren't so keen on the convergence. Here's comic book artist and creator of Captain America, the late, great Jack Kirby, talking at the 1970 Comic-Con.
I feel that science fiction has its own thinking level. I think comics is a more basic response. I feel that science fiction is a more sophisticated response. Science fiction is a sophisticated response to the incredible, or to the projected. You take a situation today and you can project it far into the future and come up with something fantastic. But you're thinking on a sophisticated level. In comics, you have to think on a more basic level. I have to show you a picture, and you have to know right away what I'm saying in that picture, what that picture is saying and what it's doing. And you can't think about it because you won't tolerate it. You won't tolerate trying to make out what I'm saying. So comics has to be quick, it's got to be firm, and it's got to tell you the story immediately in that panel. And that's why you buy comics. And that's why you understand them.
As comic fans, we were kind of at the bottom of the cultural totem pole. So, like, for instance, society at large looked down on science fiction, but even the science fiction fans looked down on us. So we were very conscious of, like, being in the bottom, and kind of like, we were just glad if anybody would hang out with us, or be willing to be seen with us.
They're just reaching deeper into our culture. I remember a story about EC that they were even reading Ray Bradbury stories without telling him, and borrowing a few of his plots. And Ray Bradbury wrote them a nice letter saying, hey, I think you forgot to send your royalty check for using that story that the other issue. And so that worked out where they decided, well, let's play ball with him and let's send him the check. And then they were able to adapt several of his stories for other EC comics.
Ray Bradbury didn't so much enjoy being labeled a science fiction writer, but his penchant for the genre, and also for horror and fantasy, made him an icon of the first geeks.
Yeah, I was a big Ray Bradbury fan. That was a huge benefit of being involved in the comic convention, was getting to meet Ray Bradbury.
I don't know if anyone's told the great story about Ray Bradbury's involvement of how Comic-Con became nonprofit.
This is something I heard from Richard Al. Richard and Shell approached Ray Bradbury at a speaking engagement, I think at UCSD, about coming to the comic convention. And Ray was interested, and he said, well, you should get in contact with my agent. You know, my speaking fee is $2,000. And Shell, on the spot, says, well, we're a nonprofit organization. And then Ray says, well, okay, then I'll do it for nothing. And that's how the comic convention became a nonprofit organization. It was completely improvised. That's how Ray agreed to come to the first one.
He was here at the very early con, but he was a friend of the convention. And he was somebody that would give, Richard Butner was the chairman there, he would give him lists of phone numbers. You know, Larry Niven, Jared Purnell, I think he's the guy that gave Shell Kurt Vonnegut's number. I mean, you know, these were, you know, it was all that network. I mean, if Ray Bradbury said it was okay, then it was okay.
And it was. His ability to translate modern issues into fantastical plots helped comic culture find a legitimate place in not just pop culture, but American culture. This was especially evident by his diehard support for a particularly edgy publication. Here's the late Ray Bradbury himself.
I've been a great collector of Mad for years. In fact, I've constantly said at all the universities and tested them to see if they'd come up with the right answer. What is the greatest intellectual magazine in the country today? And the answer is Mad. Why? Because can you name
one responsible liberal gazette or conservative gazette that has the guts and the humor at the same instant to attack with the same ferocity and wit and high style that Matt has for all these years? No, there is none. There's such a lack of sense of humor among intellectuals on both sides. I think that's a shame, because it's the only way we can survive. We're so goddamn serious about everything that we bore everyone to tears. We can't listen to these truths continually without a flash of humor, finally, to save us and save our sanity. Very important. And Mad to me is one of the great salvations of our time.
My mother didn't like Mad Magazine, but when Ray Bradbury said, "Mad Magazine by parody teaches us to see through the cloud of lies of Madison Avenue," that was it. You know, Ray Bradbury signed my hall pass.
Mad Magazine was something that, it was an eye-opener. I had a couple of friends who had a subscription to it, and I'd go over to their house for sleepovers, and I'd go pouring through these things. And unlike Boys Life, the magazine that Boy Scouts would get that also had a lot of cool cartoons in it, this, I knew I could get on the newsstand or at the local market, more likely.
Mad Magazine, I think, did a lot. It was, I don't think it can really be appreciated now, maybe because what Mad became, but in its time, when it came out, it was really subversive. Teenagers would read Mad and they would see this satire and they would see politicians and movies and all the leaders of society and society in general poked fun at and made fun of and kind of made a laughingstock. And, you know, if you read Mad in those days, like so many teenagers did, you couldn't help but start absorbing those kind of attitudes and starting to take a second look at society and see it isn't what it was supposed to be or made up to be. And there were things that were wrong and there were things that were laughable. And I think Mad was really actually really important for the counterculture.
You know, that's certainly the stuff that influenced the underground comic guys, Crumb and Gilbert Shelton and those guys. They read Mad. Harvey Kurtzman used to refer to himself as the... He wouldn't call himself the father of underground comics. He called himself the brother-in-law of underground comics.
With acknowledgement from heavy hitters like Jack Kirby and Ray Bradbury, the culture started to resonate, and everyone we talked to was proud to have been involved. Each had their own story of when comics, sci-fi, and fantasy took root in their lives. And when everyone got together for the first ever San Diego Comic-Con, all the things that made us different didn't matter at all. All that mattered was that we were all fans.
These older guys, older women were not, they weren't removed because we were all kind of, the age difference and the, you know, geographic difference, the background difference really dissolved when it came down to the subject, which was we were all interested in what we could imagine first and what was, you know, imaginatively possible. And then looking at what could be done or what could be created, not out of what you were told should be the way the world is, but the way you might imagine the world to be.
Comic books, yeah, they offered me a window into a life where the X-Men could be outcasts like me, but they still had this secret life where they were powerful and beating up bad guys. But I think characters like Spider-Man, they also are teaching us moral lessons about how to act and how to treat people around us.
Superman grew out of our personal feelings about life. And that's why quite often when we saw these, so many other similar strips coming out, we felt that perhaps they were imitating the form and format of Superman, but there was something that wasn't there, and that was this tremendous feeling of compassion that Joe and I had for the downtrodden and the people in trouble, and that is something that's in your heart and not in your pocketbook.
Science fiction has often been labeled as escapist, but you always have the question, are you escaping from or escaping to? It can be both, you know.
I would say that it was more about the mind-expanding aspect of things. Sure, it's nice escapism, but if you really want to do that, they write beach novels, you know? If I want to escape, you know, there's all kinds of stupid crap that I can read.
looking at reality or the experience you have in reality and looking at, well, what if something was slightly different? And I think that that's what is at the core aesthetically that binds, kind of unites comics fans, science fiction fans, fantasy fans, and all that, is the whole idea of speculating on reality or taking a step away from reality and thinking what alternative could there be is not only at the core of what unites these different types of fans, but also at the core of what I would say the last 30 years of progress in technology, certainly the advancement in computer science, the desire to go to Mars. You know, all these things I think are in the same camp, really.
People think similarly, and it's how we fill the need. And there's always going to be 10,000 people that try to do something, and maybe 100 people that actually do something, and maybe 10 of those people take it to market, and then maybe 2 or 3 of them are actually successful because everything comes together the right way.
This is an era where, in the main, the people who create comic books are largely unknown. For instance, if you know who the people are that create Marvel comics, it's because you read Marvel and you read the letter columns, you read the essays by the editor, and so on. To the general public, these are people that are completely unknown. And so it's very much a specialty interest, very, very much, I won't use the word cult, but it was kind of a cult, really.
We were definitely driven weirdos, and we all wound up having achieved our dreams.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to San Diego's Golden Comic Con. And right now, I'd like you to meet our founder, our advisor, all-around good guy, Mr. Sheldorf.
Thank you. There's a nasty rumor going around that people actually enjoy reading comic books. Sometimes they even learn things. However, the editors shudder at this thought that there may be some educational value involved. They're in the business of entertainment, and that's it. If the readers happen to increase their vocabularies or learn about human relations, then that's just an extra bonus. However, you and I know that the fan is a special creature who, after enjoying something good, has just got to share it with someone. If the sharing is not accomplished, God knows what the consequences could be. There's that story about the fan who, after seeing Godzilla, couldn't find a single soul to tell it to and just exploded. There's still traces of him on the ceiling of the Union Hall in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. So here we have taken the opposite approach. We have created this yearly event with the specific object of sharing in mind. This is one place where you can feel at home, sharing your likes and dislikes. During the next 3 days, many of you will make new friends, and perhaps lifelong friendships will be formed right here at this convention. It's happened before.
Next week on Comic-Con Begins, we'll look back to how the counterculture movements of the 1960s and 70s helped determine the size and scope of Comic-Con, as well as how uniting with Star Trek helped our club blast off at warp speed.
One of the really memorable figures of Comic-Con, who I met for the first time at Comic-Con, was George Clayton Johnson, the primarily film and television writer, lived in L.A.
He had written the first aired Star Trek episode. He wrote the story for Ocean's 11, the one that film was made from. And George is a really interesting character, but I was talking to him about Twilight Zone, and he said that he thought that Twilight Zone was one of the most mind-expanding things that had ever happened in American culture, that it got people to think things and see things in a way that they hadn't before to a really mass audience who normally wouldn't have watched those kinds of stories.
He was high on pot constantly, and he managed that very well in the sense that it was just George. I mean, it was sort of a maintenance program, I guess. But again, I mean, he did not force his lifestyle on anybody, but this was part of who he was, and we accepted it, and we accepted the entire package.
The only interactions I ever had with George were, you know, as part of a group, was more like after hours, you know, when the convention was over and it had died down for the evening. You know, people would mingle in different groups and just kind of talk.
I blasted out of my mind on some kind of illicit drug. And we're having some kind of like scrambled conversation. All of a sudden, at one point, all of my senses lock into a normal mode. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, huh, I'm sitting talking to that guy who wrote that really cool Twilight Zone episode when I was a kid. He's naked. I hope I'm giving you something you can use.
All of this and more on the next episode of Comic-Con Begins. Comic-Con Begins is a SiriusXM original podcast. Created and directed by Matthew Klickstein. Executive produced by Rob Schulte. Written and produced by Matthew Klickstein, Rob Schulte, and Christopher Tyler. Edited by Rob Schulte and Christopher Tyler. Mixed by James Bilodeau. Original music composed by Max DiVincenzo, produced by Foxtrax Music. With special liaison to SiriusXM, Brannon Getchess, and historical consultant Wendy Yall. Archival material and additional research provided by Mike Towery and his Comic-Con Memories website, Alan Light's 1975 Comic-Con recordings, Jackie Estrada and Comic-Con's 40th anniversary souvenir book, Pamela Jackson and San Diego State University's Comic-Con Kids Project, Maureen Cavanaugh at San Diego's KPBS, Mark Evanier, Scott Shaw, Barry Alfonso, Bill Lund, Erin Hanna, and her book Only at Comic-Con, the works of Bill Shelley, and me, your host, Brink Stevens. We obviously had many other people working tirelessly on this project behind the scenes, not to mention our nearly 100 contributing interviewees, too large in number to list here. So we ask you to take a moment to check out the fuller list of credits in the episode description. Thank you kindly. Keep listening. And from all of us at Comic-Con Begins, stay fantastic. Bye now.